Funds for Bookworm are provided in part by Lannan Foundation.
You are a human animal. You are a very special breed. For you are the only animal who can think, who can reason, who can read.
Hello and welcome to Bookworm. This is Michael Silverblatt, and today my guest is David St. John. He has two new books published just about simultaneously. The first, the newest, is The Red Leaves of Night, a new collection published by HarperCollins. The second is In the Pines. It's what he calls lost poems from 1974 to 1997, and these are the poems that were published in chapbooks between and after major collections published by the White Pine Press. Now, I've been noticing that over the many years that David St. John has been publishing and talking about his poems, their central subject is rarely addressed directly, and I want to have, with the gloves off, joke he'll know about, a talk about poetry and seduction. Now, it seems to me that one of the interesting things in these poems is that they talk directly to a reader who may be resisting their seduction, and that the poems are almost directly confrontative in a sexual way of their reader as well as the characters within the poem. And I wondered if we could begin there.
Absolutely, Michael. It's important, I think, to know it's something that I say to young writers, to think of the necessity of being able to seduce the reader into the poem, being able to allow the reader a kind of entry, but also somewhat invisibly to lure them into what will be the fabric and the constellation of the poem itself. As you know, over the years, what's interested me most in all of my poems, I think, is this axis of male-female dimension dynamic, what happens in these transactions of sexuality. And I think that it's there that people are going to provide their own resistance. In other words, I think that often a reader or at an audience, a listener is in the position of at first quite naturally being either uncomfortable, even maybe embarrassed. And one of the things that a poet is able to do, I think, is to both provide a kind of candor, but also the example of candor and the example of a kind of nakedness that's both metaphorical. And in many of the poems, especially the new poems, there's a literal nakedness with the figures in the poems that has to do not only with their encounters with each other, but also with their encounters with their experience with the world.
This is David St. John reading Portrait from his new collection, The Red Leaves of Night, and this is part of the title series of poems.
There is, in his daughter's gaze, a solemnity so elegant, it must seem to some the very definition of love, though her profile guards any true window to emotion, any genuine reflection of her understanding of her father's objective, protective despair. As her beauty is shielded by white, and her lips in their easy parting draw back from any kiss now, she is watching in the distance of the chapel a whole narrative beginning to assemble, one which finds the breath of the huge organ an unholy accompaniment, its bellows moaning heavily over what just a moment ago the virginal and clear morning had promised to unveil forever. yet which now, the white day, seems so certain to withhold.
David St. John, reading Portrait. Now, am I wrong in seeing the presence of incest lurking in the margins or in the behind the arras of this poem?
I think as I didn't want any I didn't want the suggestion of I didn't want the details of mm-hmm. an incestuous encounter. But what I did want is the maybe overzealous protectiveness of the father watching the daughter at this wedding occasion, and the way in which this moment, this being able one thinks of for the young woman to step from one realm into another realm, a realm of adult sexuality, a realm of adulthood, that what that promise seemed to her or might seem to her has already failed her, that even at that moment with the, you know, grotesquely sexual moaning of the organ, pun fully intended, that she's caught at this cusp of something, from stepping from what had been the protective and perhaps overly concerned gaze of the father into this world that the white, in fact, is less virginal than the danger, I think, of erasure.
Mm-hmm. Well, it's very odd because just as the organ has become something that moans, suddenly the word virginal appearing in this context seems akin to the keyboard instrument, the virginal, and so the pun bops back and forth, almost as if to say that the unconscious is both going to try to repress and expose at the same time.
Absolutely. And I think that that's the condition of many of the figures in these poems. That's how I see so many of them, Michael, that they're simultaneously looking to unburden themselves of some past, the history of some wreckage, some catalog of personal debris that they've brought with them. And the way in which they often choose to do that is through the vehicle of their sexuality, and that they can both lose themselves in another person, in that encounter, and maybe step out of who they've been and into some other world. And the danger, of course, is that, you know, you step out of one abyss into the next.
David St. John, reading the opening poem of his series, The Red Leaves of Night.
Sometimes, not even behind his back, his old friends called him the Chevalier d'Or, not in kindness nor even humor, but envy. And each morning, as he stepped from the ancient porcelain tub onto the freezing ochre and maroon Mexican tiles of the bathroom floor, he could see in the mist-veiled mirror that hard, wet helmet of golden hair he'd worn for years like an aging French rock star. Yet at certain moments, on particular evenings, when the light in some desolate nightclub in Nice fell just right, a woman who was a stranger might say to him how much he reminded her of Johnny Hallyday, and then his lips would glisten in the smoky air, and his eyes would blink their eloquent sadness into song, and everywhere in the world, weary, companionable women would arise and touch again the soft lute of their most ancient and trusted troubadour.
Now, I find the tone of the teasing and mischievous and jaded roué. Even here, awakening in the gaze of the women who want him to be as young and vital as once he was, to be a very troubling thing here. You'll pardon me here, but this seems to me to be your gift as a writer, that the poems have a certain knowing leer, and to examine what that leer does to others.
Yeah, I hope it's as affectionate as it is knowing. And it's, you know, certainly, I mean, we all have friends in fact, maybe close friends who fit this description, and someone who has reached the point in their life that, well, you see it a lot with American male poets, let's say, that they reach a certain stage of middle age and they're sort of emptied from the inside out, and it takes something external to awaken them again. And but for me, what's interesting is that there's a kind of reciprocity. There's a kind of sense of excitement in the relationship of the women with this guy. That what I like thinking about is what that transaction provides them all. What really interests me, Michael, is how do people keep going? What is it that allows them to continue to believe it matters to keep going? How can they continue to suffer the kinds of humiliations, the kinds of constant – they face all of these walls in their lives. They come up empty. They start over. And how is it? What do they look for? Where, at what moment, at what place, what kinds of encounters do they first question whether they can go on, and then what allows them the strength, the delusion, whatever, to continue? That really fascinates me.
Well, along with these people who are finding sometimes an old freedom, because sometimes these roué figures are described as weary. There is also a chorus of voyeurs, and it seems like ocular fixations inform this world as well, on both sides. That is to say, on one side, the ocular fixation of narcissism. On the other side of the mirror, the fixation of voyeurism. And that somehow or other, these poems are invoking the amoral world of a certain kind of poetry that includes Nerval, that includes, who else would you name?
Well, I think, you know, you could look at many of the 19th century symbolist poets, and certainly it's what they're accused of, and certainly it's, you know, what I'm often accused of as well. But it doesn't seem to me an accusation. It seems a fairly accurate description.
Yes, it seems to me that these poems implicitly take place in a world of fauns and satyrs and of willing participants and of mockers, chiders, censorious figures who stand away, but that somehow or other there seems here in this book, The Red Leaves of Night by my guest David St. John, to be penalties as well. The wall of one hotel room is spattered with the blood of the woman, one presumes, whose husband found her unfaithful in flagrante. Yeah,
Or it could be his blood.
But since I assumed it was in the room, I see. Yes. Mystery is a part of this too. But mystery seems a part of the defensiveness of the amoralist in a way.
Yeah, I actually think that My feeling about these figures is that they're less satyrs and nymphs and more fairly ordinary men and women, and that they're, in fact, not rescued by their imaginations to think of themselves as anything else. That's why the sense of, say, the mirror, the sense of the figures who are regarding themselves, the kind of narcissism. It's a narcissism that empties out into nothingness. I think for a narcissist to be successful, there has to be a self-satisfaction in the regard. I think many of the figures in these poems are unable to take much pleasure in what they see. I think the issue of the narcissism of the figures is really interesting because, for me, they're past narcissism. There's a kind of exhaustion that sets in that there's only a momentary sense of connectedness with themselves when they're engaged with the mirror of the other, of the other person. And yet the great danger of that is that whenever there's an encounter between two people, there's always the danger of losing oneself. And what could be worse from any conventionally narcissistic viewpoint?
Now, I have a kind of difficult question.
Sure.
Given the fact, on the one hand, that the poems acknowledge that infidelity exists, seduction exists, betrayal exists, these are not things that the poet is inventing. They exist in the world. And so the poet is not to be despised for invoking them. On the other hand, the poems tend to exist in the delicate space between seduction and perpetration. And eventually the whole seems designed to turn the reader's focus back on the poet in a kind of accusation. You are a seducer. You are a perpetrator. You are the explorer of these forbidden bounds. Why?
Yeah, I don't know if, in fact, the experience of the readers, it's been interesting for me to be reading these poems over the last couple of months. I've been doing a sort of insane number of readings. And in fact, the response is that that I'm getting from people is, and the people who've been reading the book, is that the poets, or I'm thought of more as a kind of Virgil-like figure, that through the kind of hellishness and the kind of inferno of what seems to be the terrain of so many of these poems, that the audience, the readers, seem to feel that what they have, in fact, is a more trusted companion to help walk through some of these things at a very intimate level. I mean, that's my hope.
Well, I remember the Robert Frost line in Directive, A Guide Who Only Has at Heart You're Getting Lost.
That's right. If a few people get left on certain levels, be it.
Because it seems to me that after a previous book, No Heaven, and even certain poems in Hush, and that there is an erotics of the perpetrator. And it seems to me that while...
I'd use a different word. I'd use the provocateur.
Uh-huh, okay.
And I think that seems to me my role. I think art has another function as well, and it's to help us to rehearse experiencing those things that we have not yet experienced. I think that you have to think of poems as pieces of consciousness. A poem is not an object, it's an experience. And as the reader experiences one of my poems or one of anybody's poems, what they're experiencing is a sequence of perceptions that have been enacted in language, in the music, in the power, the beauty, the rhythm of language. That's what a poem is. It's an experience in the way that a painting is, in the way that a movie is, in the way that a symphony is. It's not an object. The reason that that's important is that that experience becomes the reader's experience. It's an addition to their experience. In other words, as a writer, you've allowed the reader to move through a sequence of perceptions in a way that they may have never before moved through a sequence of perceptions. It seems to me that this is what art traditionally does. It arms the culture against the future. In other words, it allows us to understand through the experience of the piece of art the way in which we may have to understand something in the future. The history of the 20th century is fragmentation, disjunction, disorder. In other words, how do we allow an audience, a reader? I mean, I don't care about an audience. I care about one or two readers. My problem, it seems to me, is how do I allow a few readers to experience things in a way that's unfamiliar, even at first troubling? But finally, once they've experienced it, then maybe they won't be so troubled if this kind of fabric of experience is introduced to them at some other time. Does that make any sense?
Yes, but I want to explore it a little bit further, if
sure.
you don't mind. Because while what you present is a kind of waiting for the barbarian service of the poet who is going to prepare his audience or his one or two readers for horrors to come and that the poems will help them greet this horror, I'd like to suggest that for me at least, the figure is more closely aligned to the narrative figures in the later novels of John Hawkes, who make announcements like, "I am the white bull on the tapestry of love." In the case of Hawkes, Hawkes seems to prefer paganism. You seem to prefer decadence as the pageantry for the demonstration. But what Hawkes would talk about from the beginning of his career was a willingness to identify with the criminal.
Well, it's a willingness that I would share. Oh, absolutely. I mean, I think that, I see what you're saying, Michael. And I absolutely, I guess my hesitance is that I don't want it to seem a kind of late 19th century romantic identification. But the sense of that one being an outsider in that way, one being the criminal, one being that individual speaking from beyond the margins, it seems to me absolutely right, absolutely proper. And it's a kind of mantle I'm happy to drape all over my body. I think you mentioned No Heaven, and I think that that's an important connection to this new book. I think that the figures, as you know, the figures and the speakers in the book No Heaven were people who were living at the margins of their lives, trying to find their way back to some kind of faith, some kind of belief in almost anything. And when The Red Leaves of Night came out, a friend called and said, you know, these are the same men and women who are in No Heaven only 15 years later and a lot more desperate. And I think that's right.
Well, it seems that you've been for a while a tour guide, semi-participant in a guidebook of La Dolce Vita or something of this sort. And although I've asked the final question already, my next final question, because the subject interests me, years and years ago, faced with that kind of film,
yeah.
Pauline Kael talked about the party of the sick soul of Egypt and described it as being a sort of zombie prom, and that really she felt an American audience would more than likely get the giggles at the displays of couture, decadence, and weary fashion in these demonstrations of Marian Bod. Sometimes your poems have that edge of the ludicrous or comical.
Yeah.
And I wondered about that.
Yeah, I think that I think, for example, the poem Like Chevalier d'Or is one that certainly has its tongue firmly in its cheek for that very reason.
Another that mentions doing the holy golly with Nicole at the ashram.
Yes. And as you know, Nico's a favorite figure of mine. I think it's exactly for that reason, because the terrain of Marienbad, of La Dolce Vita, of Bertolucci, you know, all import of Eric Rohmer. I mean, these are all kinds of psychological landscapes and kinds of weathers that are really important to me, that I feel very close to. And yet, at the same time, the kinds of humor in the poems that you're mentioning, that you're painting, that you just were alluding to, is very much to co-opt that kind of response. In other words, it's to try to protect the reader from feeling the need to do that, and in fact seduce them beyond that into the more serious concerns.
It brings me to the initial subject, that ultimately, on some level, these poems are about multiform seductions, being willing to seduce the reader into accepting the subject matter of the poetry.
Well, I would say absolutely. Absolutely. And I think that the great – for me, it's one of the purposes of the music and the beauty of the poems, that it's a way to weave the reader into the poem almost before he or she knows what's happened. In other words, the force of the opening of the poems, I want the poems to sort of loop around the reader in a way that they feel – suddenly caught within the web of the poem. I want because I want to draw them into a kind of psychology that maybe they might resist otherwise, that maybe take them to a place where they might not particularly want to go otherwise.
Tell me, David, once you've seduced them, what do you intend to do with them?
Whip them within an inch of their lives. I think that it's why often the tone of the poems, at least I hope, has a kind of edginess, because I want to keep the reader somewhat off guard. I want the reader to be a little nervous about what might happen to them. I don't want them to feel too secure in maybe knowing where they are in the poem. Once they're secure, then they're safe. And if they're safe, no change is going to happen within them, it seems to me.
I've been speaking to David St. John. His most recent book is The Red Leaves of Night from HarperCollins, also recently published In the Pines from White Pine Press. Those are the lost poems from 1972 to 1997. Thank you for joining me.
Thank you, Michael.
Standing in for my associate producer, Melinda Siegel, is Carly Eisman. The engineer is Jennifer Swadek. Special production assistance today from Alan Howard, and development by Beverly Walker. I'm Michael Silverblatt. Join me again next week on Bookworm.
To the jungles you can go in books.
Funds for Bookworm are provided in part by Lannan Foundation. This program is made available to the public radio system by SAS, a satellite service of KCRW Santa Monica. Cassette copies of this and other Bookworm programs are available. For ordering information, call KCRW at 310-450-5183.
Books make you laugh and sing. Books tell you everything. They're your treasured friends in prose and rhyme.
Now with Book of the Mouse. Wow.
I want to tell you about a new show from the Financial Times called Life and Art from FT Weekend, hosted by me, Lila Raptopoulos. Life and Art is twice a week. On Mondays, I have a guest on to talk about life and how to live a good one. Everything from winter travel to cooking to living more creatively. And on Fridays, we talk art. Two FT journalists and I discuss a piece of culture that's in the air. New music, movies, and more. Find Life and Art from FT Weekend wherever you listen.